Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. As you are still probably enjoying your coronavirus lockdown with some coronavirus beer and some coronavirus alcohol, you know, things are so much better when you put coronavirus in front of it, right? No, not at all. But I'm so glad you guys are with us, at least. I hope everyone's doing well and are safe. Lots been happening, a lot of developments nationally, with, states opening up, see that coronavirus beer, just people now trying to assess and evaluate what this new space is going to look like. I sense there's a great deal of hesitancy out there, to just go headlong into normal activities. But to help us kind of understand that, along with a lot of other aspects of the period that we find ourselves in, not just coronavirus related, is a gentleman I have had the pleasure of getting to know over the past few years as we've sat next to each other on set on Morning Joe and other shows on MSNBC. Really, one of the smartest guys that I know out there on a host of issues, the Honorable Dr. Richard Haass, is a veteran diplomat, a prominent voice on American foreign policy, and an established leader of nonprofit institutions. He's currently the president of the Council of Foreign Relations, which is a phenomenally good organization doing some important work out there. 2013, he served as the chair of the multi-party negotiations in Northern Ireland that provided the foundation for the 2014 Stormont House Agreement, earning him the 2013 Tipperary International Peace Award. And from 2001 to 2003, Dr. Haass was director of policy planning for the Department of State. The good doctor has also served as a U.S. coordinator for foreign for policy toward the future of Afghanistan and U.S. envoy to the Northern Ireland peace process. He is the author of the book we're going to talk about today, The World, A Brief Introduction. I love that title. Welcome, Dr. Haass.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. Great to be with you, Michael.
It's great to have you here, Richard. Absolutely. First off, congratulations on the book. I'm particularly honored, folks, because this book was just released a couple of days ago. And so knowing how that whirlwind is when a book is just coming out, to have Richard on the program is very fortuitous for us. So business up front, everyone, definitely go check out the book. Get yourself a copy. The World, A Brief Introduction. In the book, Doctor, it's interesting, Richard, you kind of lay this out in a way that I think probably surprised a lot of people. I was looking at a couple of reviews and just sort of going through the book myself. It's interesting how you see the world and have put in and try to put in perspective some of the interesting things that we don't think about, how they drive processes and governments. And you talk about young Americans and how their lack of education in worldly things. And that's, you know, just knowing what other people are doing and how governments are functioning and run, and how older folks are just struggling just to keep up with the profound changes, whether societally, like, you know, going from a 1950s attitude to one in which gay marriage is, you know, the order of the day, and technology. How is that competition between the ignorance of the young and the inability of older generations to sort of adapt as quickly to a changing world? How does that change the course of events?
Well, again, thanks for having me. Look, your question gets at the reason I took the time to write this book, which is a very different kind of book for me. And it's meant to educate in the largest sense of the word. Let's begin with the basics. The world matters as much or more as it ever has in history. Anyone doubting that, just think for a second. The pandemic started in this obscure city in China. More than 80,000 Americans have died. Trillions of dollars of wealth have been wiped away. Tens of millions of Americans have lost their jobs. 9/11 showed what terrorists operating out of Afghanistan could do to us. Climate change, the fires in California, the floods in Texas, the storms in Florida. Again, the world is not Las Vegas. What happens there doesn't stay there. So my beginning point is the world matters. But what strikes me as I talk to a lot of people around this country when I used to travel is the sense that so many of us don't have background. We didn't study it in college. You can graduate, by the way, from the elite universities in this country, from the Harvards, the Stanfords, the Yales, the Princeton, all these places probably you could get into. I couldn't get into. and you can graduate from any one of those schools and not have to take a single course about the world that you're going to enter, and that is going to, in important ways, shape your life. A lot of people don't go to college. If you watch the nightly news, virtually none of it is about international subjects,
right,
as opposed to, say, when you and I were younger. So you have this enormous gap or gulf between the importance of the world and what we know about it, and that means, among other things, how are we supposed to be an informed citizen? How are we supposed to know what questions to ask of Donald Trump or Joe Biden in the run-up to November, if we don't know enough about the subject? But when Donald Trump, as recently as today, says he could shut down our relationship with China, the economics, we'd save $500 billion. How are you supposed to know whether what he's saying makes any sense at all economically, or whether it's complete nonsense? Or when someone says climate change isn't real, or someone says, well, we don't need our allies anymore. I can go subject after subject after subject. Well, we should get involved militarily here or there. So my question, the reason I wrote this book is I wanted to help people be better informed citizens. They could ask the right questions. They could presumably make more informed votes. They could hold elected officials to account, but also personally, they could make better career decisions. Should I go into the military? Should I go into this business? Should I make this investment decision? So the whole goal of this book is not to tell people what to think. That's for people to decide. But it's to give them the foundation and the background so they can make better decisions and better choices.
You made a couple of points there that got me thinking about the period post-World War II, the emergence of the Cold War, for example. And is it just sort of fancy or... you know, sort of idealizing a period of time where we could say, oh, well, people were so much more engaged and so much smarter about those things back then than we are today? Or has there been a fairly long, slow ride to ignorance about the world? Because I think a lot of Americans, by and large, you know, we have an arrogance about us that, you know, says, well, whether we're smart, dumb, we know everybody needs us. All right. So there's that level of arrogance. But then when you look around and you see other societies, particularly in Europe, the general wisdom or conventional wisdom is that they're smarter. They're much more clued in and tuned in than we are. Does your book get into sort of this from a U.S. perspective, or is it also a global phenomenon, for lack of a better word, that we now see ourselves in this space where we don't know as much as we think we know, and the institutions that we rely on to help us don't really do that?
I think it's global. It's probably particularly acute in the United States, given how important the United States is. So, you know, we wield tremendous power.
Mm-hmm.
We have had tremendous influence. So everything we do or don't do has significance. So there's a premium on the importance of Americans knowing about the world so they can better influence the course of American foreign policy. So the fact that many Americans don't understand how the world affects us or how we affect the world has particular significance. I think it's true in a lot of the world where people are too busy with simply surviving. I think you see, though, in the more developed countries, the wealthier countries of Europe and Asia, there, in my experience, people of almost all ages, certainly younger people at the university age, are better informed about the world than most Americans. I think that's probably true.
Has that contributed to a lot of the confusion, the disarray that we see and that we have seen in a number of areas, from foreign policy to fiscal policy, where we just seem to be just a little bit out of sorts? And while we're good up on the front end, we're not good on the back end, where the longer term thinking and planning really needs to take hold in looking at big events. You know, I look at the war in Afghanistan, for example. Yeah, great first 7 days, but the next 17 years were for shit. You know, it's like,
to use a technical word. Use a technical phrase.
Yeah, to use a tough technical phrase, right.
Well, in some cases, we're not good on the front end either. I don't think we were very good on the front end in the Iraq War of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the administration at the time and opposed it. Afghanistan, as you say, I think we were right to get involved, but things evolved in ways that the costs went way beyond any potential benefits.
Right.
Some other issues we're just ignoring at our peril. Global health, we largely ignored and we're paying a price for it. Climate change, we're largely ignoring. We're going to pay an enormous price for it. So yeah, often we're getting it wrong at both ends. I think, among other things, we exaggerate the costs of foreign policy. Just to give you one statistic, it's interesting. If you add up everything we spend on defense and related efforts, that's probably a good $800 billion a year. That's serious money. Mm-hmm. I get it. But as a percentage of our economy, of our GDP, it's roughly half or so what we averaged during the Cold War. So my point is simply that we've spent far higher levels on supporting our policy in the world in previous decades. And the last I checked, we thrived economically. So, you know, the lesson I want people to understand is we can and we should be involved in the world. Our problems at home are because of our policy at home. You can't blame the state of our infrastructure, the state of our K-12 education, the state of race relations, or anything else on the fact that we're involved in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We have public policies here at home that need improving and need fixing. So we need smart policies in the world. We need smart policies here at home. Ultimately, the fate of this country depends upon both what happens in the world and what happens here at home.
So we're now in the throes of a global pandemic, and a lot of world capitals and their respective leaders have been grappling with this, some with greater success than others. Some states, nation states, are beginning to turn the corner, but they're looming in front of them is the possibility of reoccurrence and relapse. What should be done globally in looking at, you know, the sure. lessons you're setting forth in the book? And the book, again, folks, is The World, A Brief Introduction. What should be done globally to prevent global disasters like this from having such an impact again? Is there a sure. way that we can protect our world from similar tragedies? Someone had suggested, and I thought it was an enormously good idea, and wondered aloud, well, dude, why hadn't we thought of that before? And that was, you know, sort of, you know, very much like we have when there's an air disaster. You know, we've got the, you know, all the nation's air traffic and air related agencies come into play. They all kind of work together to figure out what the how that plane disappeared or why this accident occurred. Why don't we do that on a global stage when it comes to issues like health?
Well, the answer is we have some arrangements in the world. We have the World Health Organization.
They just got the crap beat out of them by Trump and undermined their authority. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you. And look, we have these rules in the world. Years ago, the idea was that every country was going to create the equivalent of what we have in Atlanta, the Centers for Disease Control. And the idea is that every country would have a public health agency that was there to monitor the outbreak of infectious diseases, alert the world if it ever did happen. The problem in this case, China has those capabilities. They simply didn't act on. China essentially silenced public health experts who were blowing the whistle. They didn't cooperate fully with the world. They still haven't cooperated fully with the world. We still don't understand exactly how this began.
Right.
And so forth. So the problem there is not that we didn't have certain arrangements in place. It's that groups like the World Health Organization are powerless when a sovereign government basically tells them to take a hike. No international organization can tell or bought the major powers what to do any more than the World Health Organization or the UN or any other such group could tell the United States what to do. We tell them to take a hike if we didn't like the message, and that's what China did. So, the problem in some countries, they don't have the capacity. Probably half the countries in the world don't have public health systems that are up to the challenge. In China, you have a public health system that's up to the challenge. You simply had political authorities who overruled the public health authorities, and the rest, as they say, is history. Mm-hmm. So the real question is, what do you do in the world on public health? So, we try to, I think the answer going forward is we do try to strengthen a group like the World Health Organization. If the Chinese or others resist, well, then we do what we did with AIDS. Rather than looking to a group like the World Health Organization to carry most of the water, we created parallel institutions. We essentially created ad hoc institutions. We may want to do that to deal with infectious disease. And all of that, one other thing. We have to accept the fact that whatever the world does, it probably won't be adequate. So we've got to do more here at home. You can't blame what's happened here at home on China. Yes, it got here. But at some point, the blame's on us. Why didn't we have more protective equipment? Why 4 months into the crisis do we still not have anything close to adequate testing in terms of either quality or quantity? Why is it that we're likely to be rushing a return, quote unquote, to normal before we're ready for it? That's on us. So international institutions can only do so much.
Right.
At some point, we've got to have smart policy ourselves.
Well, that begs a lot, that last point, having smart policies ourselves, because as we see with a number of the healthcare officials who have been involved with this from the beginning, working with the administration, they've been put into very awkward positions trying to advocate a sound healthcare policy when the advocacy from the White House or the president sort of ventures off into a never land of a hot mess. So I've got a two-parter I want to ask you. We're going to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to ask you a two-parter about those international relations that you refer to and how they impact the healthcare system. And the second part of that is the messaging regarding this virus. How has that played a role in aiding or hurting those relations, particularly with countries like China? We're going to take a quick break so our wonderful sponsors can say hello to everybody. And when we come back, we're going to have more great conversation with Dr. Richard Haass regarding his new book out this week, The World, A Brief Introduction. We'll be right back.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
All right, everybody, welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Richard Haas. He's got a great book out, hot off the presses. Make sure you get your hot fingers on them, on that book. It's The World, A Brief Introduction. So the two-parter that I have for you, again, Richard, is you were talking about the relationships that the U.S. has with world governments and how that has played in this coronavirus environment. What do good or poor relationships like that do? How do they hinder our healthcare system's abilities to properly address something like coronavirus? And then the second part of that was the messaging regarding those policies and the virus itself that come out of the White House, you know, certainly that we hear coming from the president. What impact do they have on those relationships, particularly with countries like China, where he's clearly now zeroed in, the president has, on making China a villain or a scapegoat?
Yeah, I don't see how making China a villain or a scapegoat is going to help much. Let me try, in some ways, try to combine my answer to your two questions. If I don't get it right, come back at me. A big part of how we influence others here is by what we do. And the example we're setting is not one that others will respect or want to emulate. So I think we're reducing our influence because others look at how we're struggling to deal with the coronavirus and basically say, why should we listen to you? Well, what gives you the authority to tell us what to do given your problem? So we've really undermined our own authority and influence. And then we've made it worse, for example, when we decide not to sit down at the table when European leaders and others get together to put together money and effort on behalf of creating a global a vaccine. The idea is to pool global resources to accelerate the search for a global vaccine. And we basically said, nah, we don't need to be a part of that. We'll just do it ourselves. So that reinforces the sense that the United States is not serious about international leadership. It doesn't take place in a vacuum. You know, we've opted out of all sorts of other collective efforts. And if, by the way, this effort proves successful without us, why do we think we're going to be anywhere except at the end of the line when it comes to who gets it? So it seems to me it makes no sense whatsoever. You know, on China, I'd say one other thing, Michael. Before this crisis even began, before you or me or anybody ever heard of COVID-19, the U.S.-Chinese relationship was getting worse. That's significant because this is probably the most important relationship of this era of history, just like the U.S.-Soviet relationship was the most important one in the previous era during the Cold War. So as goes this relationship, so will go a lot of the 21st century. And what's clear to me is this crisis is going to make it a lot worse. And each side is sticking the other one, blaming them, bad-mouthing them. So I worry that not only will it not help us get out of this crisis, for example, it makes it harder to have any medical cooperation. It makes it harder for us to pool our resources economically to help struggling countries around the world. But this could also poison efforts, say, to do something about North Korea's nuclear program,
right,
or Iran's. I mean, the other issues haven't gone away. You know, we're talking about COVID-19 for good reason and the pandemic. But it's not like there's this giant pause button out there in the middle of the planet that anybody has the finger to press.
Right.
The rest of history is going on, and it ain't getting better.
Yeah, and I think that's a hard truth that a lot of folks don't necessarily wrap their head around, which sort of brings me back into some of the details of your book, because the goal of The World, A Brief Introduction, is really to create, a level of knowledge. I think you referred to it as global literacy, so that we understand how all these things that seemingly are separated and not necessarily connected are in fact connected, and that, like dominoes, when one falls, if it falls correctly, then everything kind of lines up. If it falls incorrectly, yeah, the first few dominoes may fall the right way, but then the whole thing kind of falls apart. So it does matter that we understand how these things work and are connected. How do you see in your writing of the book Americans walking away from reading the book and then being able to navigate their lives amidst something like this pandemic or some of the other things that you touch on in the book, you know, from monetary policy to, you know, foreign affairs.
Well, look, again, thanks for asking that. You know, I try to give people the history they need, the background they need about each of the world's regions. I take 10 pressing global issues like global health, like climate change, like terrorism, like trade, like cyberspace, and give people the basics of those. I talk a little bit about how the world works and some of the big ideas out there. The whole idea is to make people, let me give you a language equivalent. I don't think anyone could read this book and become fluent. And after reading this book, they're ready to be Secretary of State.
I was hoping.
I know. I could say a lot of things, but I've learned not to say everything that pops into my head. But it will make them conversant. It will make them smart enough and prepared enough so when they hear the president or a senator or anybody else say, we ought to go to war here, or we ought to bash this ally there, or we should support a tariff here or a sanction there, or climate change is not real, or whatever their position is that they're articulating, I want people to be able to hear that and go, that makes sense, you know, or just the opposite. Mm-hmm. I want them to be able to say, look, I know about that. That guy or that person doesn't know what he or she's talking about. That's not in my interest, or that's not in the country's interest. I want them to get to the point where they can hear stuff and basically filter it and make sense of it and reach an informed decision so they can then act politically. They can support this candidate or this cause, or they could oppose it. Or they may say, I want to join the military, or I want to join the Foreign Service, or I want to make an investment in this country, or I want to travel to that country. There's so many things we do that are affected by the world. And my goal, again, is not that everyone comes out of the book and does what I do for a living.
Right.
I don't expect people to dedicate their lives to studying it. You know, I've been lucky enough. I've been able to work for 4 presidents in 4 different administrations. But what I do want is anyone coming away from reading the book, again, to be comfortable with making sense of all the stuff that they're going to hear and read. So then they can make some better choices.
So this was not just a theoretical exercise for you.
Oh, hardly. This is real. This is very different for me. I've written, 14 other books.
Mm-hmm.
And they're essentially books more for better or for worse for people like me. They're books for people who get up in the morning. The first thing they turn to, maybe after the sports pages or page 6 in the New York Post, is they turn to the international news. They read the Financial Times. They read the New York Times. And they live, they eat, they breathe these issues. They read Foreign Affairs magazine. They care about the latest statement from the State Department. Those are all my previous books. This is a book for people that I hope people who are in that world still find this of value. I think they will. But my principal audience is the other 325 million Americans and other people around the world who haven't made this a big priority in their lives. And what I'm basically saying is you need to make it a bigger priority. It will affect your life, and you need to get up to speed on it. And that's essentially my message.
I think it's a good message. I think it's an incredibly important and smart message for people to take to heart, because a lot of what we see today, particularly in the age of fast-paced media, 24-hour news clocks, Twitter, Facebook, and specifically where people just throw crap up and preach it as gospel, when in fact is nothing but, you know, pure crazy insanity, conspiracy theory BS. And yet it is given a level of sincerity and seriousness that I think is damaging. So it's important to have a resource, as you've said a couple of times now, that people can, you know, take the book and use it almost as a reference book, an encyclopedia. It's whatever you, however you want to, you know, treat it, but, you know, learn something so that when you're hearing the rest of the world speak around you, you can discern the crap from the good stuff and be
Absolutely.
Able to intellectualize and ask the proper question. Well, wait a minute. If what you're saying is true, then how come A, B, C, and D? You know,
100%. Look, one of my biggest takeaway from my time in government, and I've been lucky. A lot of times, I've been in the Oval Office or the other room where the decision was being made. Is almost nothing is inevitable.
Right.
The decisions that people you and I have both met and worked with make real differences. It wasn't inevitable that all these 80,000 plus Americans would die in this crisis. It was inevitable that the virus would reach the shores of the United States once the Chinese made the bad decisions they made. It wasn't inevitable they'd made those decisions, but we can't influence that.
Right.
They made those bad decisions. But the decisions we've made, the messaging that the president and governors have issued, the lack of priority in developing a national testing capability. I could go on and on. These are consequential decisions. A decision a previous president made not to respond when chemical weapons were used in Syria, or his predecessor to go to war in Iraq.
Right.
I could go down. Every president makes any number of truly consequential decisions and choices in terms of using or not using military force, in terms of diplomacy, in terms of economics. And my point is, as a citizen, you want to be in a position to respond to that. You want to be even better in a position to ask these people before they become president. You don't want to be surprised if you can help it.
Right.
So before you vote this November, I would hope that people would read this book, and then they could go to the website for the candidates, look at what they're saying. They could go to rallies if we again have rallies, or they could go to pub town hall meetings, and they could ask questions. And they could then make a decision, hey, I'm going to support Joe Biden or I'm going to support Donald Trump because I agree with this or I disagree with that, or this same thing for this senator or this House candidate. That to me would be real, real progress, because that would also send a message to these candidates that the American voters are better informed. They are watching. They understand the issues more. They're not going to believe stuff that isn't true. That to me would be a really good day for American democracy.
Well, my guest, Richard Haass, Dr. Richard Haass, the author of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction, hopes you read the book before the election. I would highly recommend you read the book if you want to be smart and prepared to understand and tackle for yourself some of these big pressing questions and some of the nuances of policy and the like. This is the place to do it. It is... A compact, honest evaluation, assessment of the world as it is, and with insights from the good doctor, from his years of experience in foreign policy, domestic policy, working, as he said, with four presidents. Richard, I wish you every success for this book. It's a good book, and we will definitely be pushing it with our viewers and listeners, and really hope that a lot of people take to heart some of the lessons that you're teaching here.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it, and good to hear you, if not see you.
You got it, my friend. You got it. Well, that does it for this episode of the podcast, folks. As always, I'm very happy to have you ride along with us, and I'm particularly pleased to have had with us Richard Haass, who is one of the best out there. You'll see him for sure on MSNBC and other programs. He is the current president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the book, again, check it out on Amazon or wherever you get your books, is The World, A Brief Introduction. All right, folks, I'll catch you all next time. Until then, don't forget to do that download thing. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get to download on. I'll be back at you next week. And until then, stay safe, stay smart, be well. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.